Tuesday, March 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The second patient who's now free of the HIV virus is in London.
We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives launched a wide-ranging investigation yesterday of President Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, his businesses, and his transition to power. Well, it's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump assailed Democratic lawmakers today for opening a wide-ranging investigation of him and his administration, calling it a big, fat fishing expedition in search of a crime. He contended that Democrats in the House of Representatives, who yesterday demanded documents from 81 people and entities linked to his 2016 campaign, his businesses, and his two-year tenure as president, have gone stone-cold crazy, he says. He said letters looking for information were sent to innocent people to harass them. Also on Twitter, he called the House Judiciary Committee investigation the greatest overreach in the history of our country. The Dems are obstructing justice and will not get anything done, said Donald Trump. Well, to help put this all in perspective is our VOA congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, who joins me now in the studio. And thank you so much for joining me, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
Well, Catherine, so why are the Democrats launching this widespread investigation?
Well, the most basic answer to that is that the U.S. Congress has oversight responsibilities. They have oversight responsibilities over the executive branch, over the president of the United States. They have this ability to look into whether or not he committed crimes. So, you know, when they hear the president say that, I know that House Democrats will be pushing back against that assertion from the White House. They will say that this is not a fishing expedition, that this is part of what they need to do to determine if President Trump has any connections to overseas entities, if he's fulfilling his duties as president because of those connections, because his family might have business connections. Now, usually when investigations like this happen, they do turn out to be wide-ranging. You need to build a picture of a person's business connections, their personal connections, and that can end up seeming like a fishing expedition. That's what happened in the case of President Clinton, where one element was initially investigated and then it connected to other elements. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out and what Democrats do to connect the dots on this investigation.
Also, what specific crimes are they alleging that he has committed?
Well, they aren't alleging that he committed crimes per se, so much as saying that they want additional information on his business dealings, on his connections with Russia. Remember, the Mueller investigation is only looking at one narrow range of issues, that Trump campaign connections with Russia. This is much bigger. This is looking at the so-called hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, whether that violated campaign finance, a number of other issues that they'll be looking at.
Also, what types of documents are they demanding at this point?
They're looking into all sorts of campaign finance, you know, the hush money checks. They're looking at business dealings, tax returns, a whole range of documents.
Also, many supporters are saying that Congress really has done nothing else but investigate President Trump since he's been in office and should be working more towards working for the people of the country. So what else are they doing and what are Democrats saying to this?
Well, it's an interesting week for that criticism to come up because Democrats are actually putting their signature piece of legislation on the floor for a vote this week. And that's what they're calling H.R. 1, the People's Act, which is addressing a range of issues, campaign financing, ethics, voting rights, things that they said they heard from voters on the midterm campaign trail, concerns people have about the state of American democracy and whether American voters can believe in their elected officials. You'll hear a lot of pushback from Democrats on that criticism this week.
And also, what has this been done to any other president? This type of investigation?
Well, there are certainly other times where the U.S. Congress has looked into presidents, namely during the Watergate investigation. But in terms of the scope, this is certainly new. This is certainly new.
This is historic.
This is historic, and it'll be very interesting to see because we're not used to having a president who will come out fighting so openly on Twitter. All of the social media is so new. It'll be really interesting to see what that means, that interplay between the presidency and the U.S. Congress.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That's VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, moving on, Democrat Hillary Clinton, who lost the 2016 U.S. presidential election to Donald Trump, is ruling herself out of a rematch in 2020 as he seeks a second term in the White House. She says, "I'm not running, but I am going to keep working and speaking and standing up for what I believe." A long list of Democratic challengers has already announced they are seeking the Democratic Party presidential nomination to oppose Trump, including five women in Congress. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Clinton's key challenger for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination, has announced he is running again. Another prominent Democrat, former Vice President Joe Biden, says he is in the final stages of deciding whether to run. Well, Venezuelan opposition leader and U.S. recognized interim president Juan Guaido has returned to Venezuela after meeting with leaders in neighboring countries to seek support. Guaido was not prevented from re-entering the country or detained yesterday, as he had been feared. My colleague Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with Eric Farnsworth about the situation in Venezuela. Farnsworth is vice president of the Council for the Americas Washington office and an expert on Latin American affairs.
Does Guaido have enough support to assume leadership? And what about the army?
Well, Guaido has the support of the Venezuelan Constitution. And without a free and fair vote, one can't say whether or not the majority of the population of Venezuela support him or some other candidate. But the truth is, based on polls, that Mr. Maduro has lost a lot of support. Probably his support is in the 20% range or so. And that, again, according to polls, a majority of people do celebrate the fact that Guaido is the interim president and so would give him their support. And in fact, are very strongly of the view that he should assume the duties of the presidency, not just the role. So then the question becomes, well, how can you do that? And as you rightly ask, where does the military sit? The military, in some ways, is the arbiter in Venezuela of what happens next, because they have the guns, they have the ability to influence who is actually able to exercise power. To this point, they've remained loyal to Mr. Maduro in large measure, although you do have an increasing number of military officers as well as enlisted members who have defected and gone to Colombia and other places. The idea would be that over time, a quorum or a majority of those officials, those military members, would throw in their support with Juan Guaido, and that would give him the capability of really exercising the prerogatives of the presidency to which the Constitution grants him.
And what is the wild card, the thing that people are not paying attention to that you believe is the most important here? Who are the other players beyond the neighboring countries that might play a role here?
Well, I think there are several. The greatest wild card, in my view, is China. China is a country that has invested literally billions of dollars in Venezuela through loans and through some investments, and really over the years has played a very large role in providing resources to the regime in Venezuela. But you know, in order to get paid back, the Chinese really have to see in Venezuela a vibrant oil economy, an economy that's working well, that where the leadership is legitimate and can pay back its debts. And that's not the Venezuela of today. So if China is really interested in having their debts repaid, and I believe that they are, I believe that the best chance of having them repaid in that manner is with a Guaido interim government and then a free and fair election afterward. It's also it has to be said that China has a very large role in Latin America broadly, and it's growing by the year. But if they're on the wrong side of history in Venezuela, it's unclear what sort of reception they'll continue to receive around the rest of Latin America. So the wild card here would be whether or not China is willing to change its support from Maduro to support the Venezuelan Constitution, as the United States and Canada, Europe, and much of Latin America has already done.
That was my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. speaking with Eric Farnsworth of the Council of the Americas, America Society. Among the top stories in the world, Pakistan detains dozens of suspects in the deadly February 15th bombing in Indian Kashmir. India downplays the impact of U.S. plans to end New Delhi's preferential trade status that allows duty-free access to products worth $5.6 billion. And China plans a series of new moves to unify with Taiwan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The UN mission in Libya announced that UN envoy Ghassan Salameh met in the UAE with Fayez al-Sarraj, chairman of the Libyan Presidential Council, and Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army. The meeting produced an agreement to end the transitional phase of government and hold general elections to preserve the unity of Libya and its state institutions. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor at the Libya Analysis Consulting Agency in London, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi about what the agreement means.
This meeting is more an attempt by the UN and Hassan Salami to exert some kind of control over the Libyan political process again and re-inject some energy into the political process. What has happened, however, is that Khalifa Haftar and his forces have made significant gains in the south of the country, both sort of militarily taking territory, but also in enforcing some sort of security and reopening supply lines to the region. And this has gained him a great deal of popularity, both in the south and partly in western Libya. And what this has done is effectively shift a lot of their political power, and this has ended up derailing the kind of existing political process that was happening. So although the outcome of this meeting has been to say that they will end the transitional period and hold elections, this is actually nothing new. They already agreed to this back in November. At that point, the idea was to have a national conference, and this was meant to be the next stage in the political process, whereby lots of different Libyans would come together and decide more of the details of how to move out of the transitional phase. The interesting thing about this meeting is the national conference was not mentioned at all. So it's not clear if that's going to happen or if that's been completely scrapped. So in short, this meeting seems much more like a PR opportunity, and it isn't really that significant in terms of changing the reality on the ground or even giving more momentum to the UN process.
Rina, there was also no mention in that meeting of drafting a constitution. Would holding elections without a constitution in place bring stability to Libya?
And this is another area where views in Libya are polarized. So some want to push through the draft constitution first before holding elections to provide a framework. Others want to have elections first, have more of a stable government in place before finalizing the constitution. However, pushing or rushing through the draft constitution without giving the necessary thought to it, the necessary discussion, I think could actually create longer-term instability. Already, the draft constitution that exists has a lot of issues with it. There are a lot of groups who have already said that they would boycott it. And I think that's another pragmatic issue, that even if they push ahead and hold the referendum on this draft constitution, which is currently the kind of plan that the Libyan authorities are working to, it's actually very unlikely that this draft constitution would be passed in a referendum, and therefore that could just lead to a longer delay of the elections or more division and controversy over that process. So this is certainly an issue where there is no clarity at the moment, and this meeting between Sarraj and Haftar has not cleared that up in any way.
That was Rhiannon Smith with Libya Analysis in London. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawi. Well, researchers are set to present to a conference today the second known case of a person showing no sign of the virus that causes AIDS after undergoing a stem cell transplant and halting the use of antiretroviral drugs. Jackie Quinn reports.
The second patient, who's now free of the HIV virus, is in London. Like the first patient, he developed a blood cancer, so when he needed a stem cell transplant, researcher Ravindra Gupta looked for a donor with a gene mutation that creates natural resistance to HIV.
An improbable event.
The London patient has gone 18 months without treatment.
Too early to say as to whether this is a cure or not.
But he says the stem cell transplants are so risky. The first patient who is HIV-free after a stem cell transplant for leukemia is Timothy Ray Brown of Seattle.
I'm so glad to have a family member added to my family.
Researchers writing in the journal Nature are hoping these two cases can open new doors for treatment. I'm Jackie Quinn.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Normally, the Vatican waits 70 years after a pontificate ends to make available the relevant.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
As Uganda's population increases, many young people are finding it difficult to find jobs that pay well. A government directive to introduce the teaching of Chinese in schools may offer better employment opportunities. Halima Afmani reports from the town of Luwero.
In Uganda, Mandarin Chinese is called the language of the future. And here, at Everest College in Luwero District, secondary students recite a poem about treasuring life. China is a major trade partner and investor in Africa, and many countries are encouraging their citizens to learn the language. Last year, Uganda's Ministry of Education named 35 schools countrywide where the Chinese language would be taught. The decision was driven by the ties between the countries, says Grace Waguma, director of the National Curriculum Development Center.
There is a lot of economic activities, infrastructure development, medical, name it, that China is working with Uganda. And many of our people, the Ugandans, are trading with China. So China has become a country that we need to get to know and get into it. And the only way we can do it is also through the languages.
Chinene Charles is one of the students learning Mandarin at Everest. He thinks the language will open up job opportunities.
I'm interested in learning Chinese because it can help me to be employed in Chinese companies. And if I have a friend who knows Chinese, can get a job and invite me to act as an interpreter in Chinese anniversaries.
For the last 4 years, the Confucius Institute at Makerere University has been instructing students in Chinese. The students are now being assigned to different schools in the country to teach the language. Namisi Moses Apollo says that he was a poor student in his regular schooling and he worried about finding employment. But he says that for him, learning Chinese was easy, and upon graduation, he was immediately asked to start teaching in a pilot class in Luwero. According to Namisi, there are vast opportunities in Uganda for people who can teach Chinese, though he notes that in most cases, it's the Chinese government paying the salaries and one has to be very professional.
The market is vast open, but you also have to be, I would say, a titan at negotiations to get the best out of it. You need to give it your best. You need to play your S at last. That is how you can be able to get the job. So you have to be not only good at Chinese language, but also at the culture and the communication skills.
Lao Da Chu Shang Fei. Yes, I remember those kids used to sing.
Visiting Chinese officials have over the years emphasized what they call the template of Africa-China cooperation. China has funded many large infrastructure projects in Uganda, including the 600-megawatt Karuma hydropower project with a price tag of $1.8 billion, and a highway between Kampala and Entebbe, which cost $350 million. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Luero, Uganda.
This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA retired its Kepler spacecraft at the end of October, but among its last observations on February 4, 2018, the Planet Hunting Space Telescope helped give teams of astronomers an extraordinary look at the very first moments of a violent stellar explosion called a Type 1A supernova. Past research indicates that typical Type 1A supernovas usually grow in brightness over the span of a couple of weeks before it fades away, but the astronomers noticed that this particular supernova was unusual because it quickly brightened in just a few days after its initial explosion. Scientists considered Type 1A supernovas important to understanding the workings of space and are used as cosmic rulers to measure distances across the universe. To make their observations and develop their findings, the teams of astronomers used both space and a variety of ground-based observatories. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Australia is planning to build a new multi-billion dollar underground hydropower station in a remote corner of the Snowy Mountains in New South Wales. It is a huge and complex engineering task and could generate electricity for 500,000 homes. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The plan to generate power in the Snowy Mountains is ambitious. Here is how it would work. When solar and wind farms create and deliver more energy than is needed, that spare capacity would in turn pump water between two reservoirs in the Kosciuszko National Park. The water would pass up through 26 kilometres of underground tunnels and pipeline to the higher of the two artificial lakes. When wind and solar can't meet demand for power, water would be released back down the tunnel, turning turbines to generate hydroelectricity. The task ahead for engineers is significant. The tunnel would have to pass through five different types of rock, as well as several rivers and creeks. Before the five-year project goes ahead, a study will determine if the hydroelectricity plan is both feasible and economically viable. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes the scheme will become a reality.
It delivers as part of our sustainable plan to meet our emissions reductions targets and ensure that the renewable power revolution that has been going on in Australia over recent years is able to be maintained through the firming power support that comes out of projects like this.
The project revives memories of the original Snowy Hydro scheme that was at the time Australia's biggest engineering project. Construction began in 1949 and ended in the mid-1970s and is considered to be a true nation-building enterprise. Recent research by the Australian National University suggested that at the current rate, Australia could expect to be 100% powered by green energy sources within 15 years. Wind and solar dominate the renewable power sector, although the majority of Australia's electricity is still generated by coal. The centre-right government has said it won't phase out the use of coal-fired power generation in Australia, despite concerns that fossil fuels are contributing to global warming. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.